Do you like sports? Do you like art? What about science? Giraffes? Giraffe scientists that paint rugby games? It's all available on Audible, the biggest audiobook site with the largest selection of audiobooks this side of the inner solar system. No need to use your boring old eyes anymore. The ears are the future, my friend. Why, you're using them right now. So check out Audible and get your listen on. Go to www.readlearnlivepodcast.com/audible to start your 30-day free trial today.
With any, you know, any work of fiction, I hope asks the reader to ask themselves, if I were this person in this situation, what would I do? How would I feel? How would I act? What would I do? And so thinking about being in a fraught political moment, how would I behave? What would I need to do to stay safe or to prevent things from getting worse?
Hello and welcome to Read, Learn, Live, the podcast about improving yourself through literature. I'm your acclaimed host, John Monaster, and I'd like to welcome you to episode 28. We sure are close to 30. As always, if you have ideas for books you'd like to see featured or of authors you want to put me in touch with, you can reach me at jon@readlearnlivepodcast.com. Today, I'm delighted to have the opportunity to speak with author Anka Salaji about her book, Daughters of the Air. Anka Salaji is a Brooklynite living in Seattle. Her fiction appears in Gastronomica, Fairy Tale Review, Washington City Paper, and elsewhere. Her nonfiction appears in Los Angeles Review of Books, Electric Literature, Jewish in Seattle, Kirkus, and elsewhere. She is the recipient of fellowships and awards for Made at Hugo House, Jack Straw Cultural Center, For Culture and Artist Trust. The Stranger hailed Anka as one of the fresh new faces in Seattle fiction. Her debut novel, Daughters of the Air, is forthcoming from Lantern Fish Press in December 2017. I hope you enjoy our conversation as much as I did. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Read, Learn, Live podcast. I'm your host, John Monaster. I'm super excited today to be speaking with Anka Salaji about her book, Daughters of the Air. Anka, say hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you. We're so glad you could join. And I'm really interested and excited to talk to you about this book because it's so interesting on so many levels. But first off, I always like to ask authors to sort of summarize the book for us in their own words.
Sure. So Daughters of the Air is about a girl, Pluta, whose father disappears during Argentina's dirty war. And her mother is unable to explain to her what has happened and sends her away to boarding school for safekeeping. But Pluta is increasingly distraught and angry and confused, and she runs away. And so the novel explores the father's disappearance and Pluta's running away.
Yeah. So first off, I want to talk a bit about the writing process and the research you did. And so, just generally, could you talk about what it was like putting the book together?
So this book I worked on for a very long time. I started thinking about the topic back in 2003 or so, when I had first learned about what Argentina's dirty war was, and I just needed to know more about it. So I spent a lot of time researching that history. And then at the same time, I was thinking about these characters, particularly this strange girl that I kept seeing, who ended up being Pluta. I kept seeing her in the neighborhood of Gowanus in Brooklyn, and I couldn't figure out why. It's this industrial neighborhood, and in the 90s, when I was in high school, I took dance classes there. So it had always intrigued me as this strange place, and of course it was much more dangerous in 1980 when the book takes place. But eventually the dirty war became Pluta's history. And so the two things that I did in the process, in addition to just spending a lot of time researching that history, I actually found it really helpful to look at a lot of visual art as prompts. And so for the first draft, which took a while, as a starting point, I would pick a random piece of art. I had this collection of Dover art stickers, you know, those cheap little stickers you can get at a stationery store, and stick it in my notebook so the page was less blank. Mm-hmm. And then I would see what, you know, see how the painting would speak to me. Eventually, there were three painters that kept speaking to the characters. Modigliani inspired the mother, Chagall inspired the father, and Kandinsky inspired Pluta. And so I kept doing that until I finished a first draft. And there was a lot of groping around in the dark because I wasn't sure what I was doing yet, but it certainly, I think, created some surprises in the process. And then after that, the process maybe resembled more what a lot of other writers go through in the revision process, trying to figure out the structure, taking out characters, chopping up timelines, so on and so forth. Yeah.
Yeah. Within all of that, would you say that there was any particular task or part of the process that was particularly difficult for you?
Getting that first draft down, making meaning out of it, and then eventually trying to decide what I wanted to do with it. I think that was the hardest transition. It was going from the first draft to the second draft. Once I had resolved to completely rewrite the book, things got easier.
Ooh, that sounds like a tough decision to make, though.
It was a tough decision, but I realized that the writing would be a lot better that way. I think when you try to revise like a Word document and like take out characters, it turns into like this weird Frankenstein thing where things just don't seem right. And also, you'll never rewrite a bad sentence. So rewriting the whole book allowed me to make the writing better as well.
Ah, that's a good point. One of the things that's kind of remarkable about the book is that it has a really good sense of place, and it takes place in the late 70s and early 80s all over the world. We've got South America, Europe, the US, back and forth. And I think you have a really keen eye for detail, and you really spend some time in the book to bring your reader to those places and those times. How did you research what those places were like, you know, over 35 years ago?
So a lot of it was library research, and Google Images helped a little bit, although sometimes it can be hard to place a year with an image that way. And for like the New York sections, there are certain websites like Ephemeral New York and Forgotten New York that were kind of useful. But then finally, like the thing that was most useful in terms of researching Argentina specifically was I got to go to Buenos Aires in 2010. And, you know, in addition to being there and walking the streets, there was in the Museum of the City of Buenos Aires, their library was amazing. It was small, but I asked librarians for help, and they gave me like just a pile of magazines from like the 60s to the 80s. And so I was able to get like a vivid picture of at least popular culture in that time, what people wore, the celebrities they were interested in, and also, you know, what they weren't talking about in like the equivalent of People magazine, you know, in that time of violent repression. So that was super helpful.
Mm-hmm. Huh. And from that, was there anything in particular that surprised you? So either something that you found in the research or something that came out within the story as you were writing it?
From that pile of magazines?
Sure.
Or I think one thing that ended up in the book was a famous like 1983 cover of, again, like the equivalent, Gente is the People magazine. And it was about the Falklands War, which was the war that ended up ending the dictatorship. But before that happened, there was a headline that said, "We're winning." And then like 2 months later or something like that, they lost. And so that was really helpful for me in terms of thinking about media coverage there in that time. And and related to that, one other thing that I learned was that the mothers of the disappeared, so the women who would protest in front of Casa Rosada, who had children who had been, arrested, adult children who had been arrested, they were not called mothers of the disappeared in the media there. They were called Las Locas, which means the crazy ladies. So that became an important part of the book as well. When Isabel, the mother, is abroad, she doesn't see them referenced as Las Locas, right? In an Italian newspaper, they're referred to as the mothers of the disappeared. So that's kind of a big shift for her in understanding how things are being perceived.
Yeah, and to kind of tie into that, this is some really heavy stuff. I mean, this is some serious, and we'll get into some of the stuff that happens in the book as later, but just even what we've talked about so far, the war and the disappearances, this is really intense material. And so I wondered if you had any personal connection or what drew you to this material in the first place.
I don't have a personal connection to Argentina, but I am the grandchild of Holocaust survivors. And one of the reasons I needed to know more about the Dirty War was as I was reading about it, it sounded an awful lot like the Holocaust. And so I was trying to figure out how something like that recurs, right? At the time, I was, I don't know, maybe naive. I thought we had learned something from the Holocaust, and that sort of thing wasn't going to happen again. And so I was trying to understand the psychology behind that, how people turn a blind eye. And also thinking about, as I was exploring that sense of loss in the book, I was thinking about, not knowing exactly what had happened to certain family members. My grandfather was a teenager, and he was a political prisoner for most of the war. And his brother died. Supposedly, he fell off a train. But the family suspects, of course, that he was thrown off the train. And so there are a lot, there's stories like that that I think about when I'm trying to understand other similar situations.
One of the things that you did with the book was you told the story in a very interesting and non-linear way. We kind of jumped back and forth between different parts, and they're pretty close together. We jump back and forth between a bulk of the book is between Brooklyn in 1980 and Buenos Aires in 1978, and as the book gets further along, kind of the timeline starts to narrow and they intertwine a bit and other stuff starts happening. So it's a bit unique. And so I was wondering why you decided to structure the narrative that way.
So initially, the first draft was chronological. And then when I decided to rewrite, it seemed like it would be more compelling to put together those two disappearances, the father's disappearance and the daughter's disappearance, and have them explore them side by side. His being the unresolved disappearance of the father being the cause of the daughter's running away.
All right, well, let's start talking about the book itself. We've dropped enough breadcrumbs, I think, at this point about what's actually going on. And so, yeah, one of the very first things that happens in the book. You see the family. You see Daniel, Isabel, and Plutha together as a family, and then Daniel is disappeared or kidnapped. And so I think then the rest of the book is about them dealing with this sudden loss. And I was curious about your sense of how people deal with sudden loss and how you've noticed other people around you in real life that have dealt with that, whether you had any personal connection to that or friends of yours had connection, and sort of how you were able to breathe life into the characters of Isabel and Plutha using that kind of baseline of a sudden loss at the beginning of the book.
So, I mean, in addition to family stories, which, you know, there's sudden loss, but in the past that I didn't directly experience. I mean, I've had sudden loss in my life in different, you know, different circumstances, but there's a visceral reaction where there's like a physical pain in response to it, which I was kind of exploring a bit from Plutha's perspective. She has a very visceral experience of the world. But also there's a ghostliness in a way, a sense that, you know, because the loss is sudden, it's hard to imagine the person gone. So their presence is still kind of there, as if you could pick up the phone and give them a call. Or, you know, in modern times, like today, like you can still go to the person's Facebook page. So there's something like they're still out there, even though you don't want to face the idea that, you know, there might not be a response.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly what Plutha was doing. You know, the way that you talked about it in the book was she really held on to that idea that her father was coming back for a while. That, you know, maybe it's just going to be a couple days. All of a sudden he'd pop up and, you know, they could watch movies together or do activities together, just like the old days. And so I think you're right. That, I mean, that's definitely how she experienced it. I mean, maybe you could, to take a step back, talk about the relationship that Plutha had with her father, because I think then, especially comparing that versus the relationship she had with her mother at the beginning, then set the stage for a lot of the reactions between Isabel and Plutha.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of what makes it especially painful, is that her relationship with her father is better than her relationship with her mother. They connect on, you know, he reads to her fairy tales and mythology, and the mother is a bit more distant and a bit more unhappy with the way her life has turned out. And so she's a bit more distant and ambivalent about being a mother. And that's part of what creates more distance between them. But the father, you know, he's a warm character. And I think that's one of the reasons I kept going back to Chagall's paintings when I was writing him, is that there's a warmth in those paintings. You know, and he's more intellectual. He's interested. He has a curiosity about the world that I think Plutha has. So that's part of what makes everything so difficult once he's gone, is Plutha and Isabel have a much more difficult relationship.
Mm-hmm. And eventually, you know, the Plutha and Isabel move to New York and Plutha starts school, and you have her very quickly escape from that, you know. So she runs away from boarding school. And interestingly, she picks a time to run away when, you know, Isabel is also away. You know, it's almost as if Isabel is also running away. Isabel's in, I believe, in Rome at the time. So Plutha runs away and she gets a ride from this guy, Bobby, who's, you know, also a teenager, it seems, and just happens to be driving by, picks her up. And that kind of starts her Brooklyn adventures. And she goes and gets a tattoo and, you know, hangs out with Bobby and stuff happens. But they establish a relationship, and just as that relationship is getting established, you know, Bobby just kind of goes nuts and throws her out. And I feel like this happens a lot in the book. You know, Pluta really gets the short end of the stick. She is constantly meeting people who are nice at first, but cause problems for her later. It just seems like she's involved in a constant struggle. How is she able to manage this, that her life is such a struggle after she's run away?
Well, I think, you know, as a runaway, you're vulnerable to a lot of those things, right? So initially trusting Bobby, initially trusting, there's one other character that seems harmless at first that turns out to be pretty awful. She falls prey to that because she's alone. And in the instance of Bobby, like, he has kind of more of a, to an extent, in a protective instinct as another young person who's in some ways also vulnerable, but in other ways a little sketchy. But that instance of him kind of freaking out, he's worried he'll do something he'll regret. So that that series of obstacles that she continues to face comes in part from that vulnerability and comes in part from that unresolved tragedy with her father. So she kind of keeps reliving traumatic events, but she's also strong. And so she, you know, she eventually deals with it in her own special way. She's a really gritty character. She uses her grit, as she's on the brink of, just total breakdown. There is a strength in her as well.
Yeah, and to me that played out in a really interesting way, related to what I wanted to talk about next, which was kind of one of the most shocking things in the book, the fact that she becomes a prostitute at a very young age. I think she's 14. And I wanted to quote a line that you wrote. I thought it was very, very interesting to me. You wrote, "The possibilities of the body, of what it could do, why people did what they did, why she did what she did, and maybe that wasn't entirely animal, or at least maybe the animal in question was human. Thinking this, she felt very mature, as if she had made a major discovery." So these are Pluto's inner thoughts, you know, as she's contemplating doing this, as this is happening. And to me, this is just sort of almost mind-boggling, right? I think for many people, it's not at all what people would be thinking, you know, as they were sort of watching other prostitutes go ply their trade and thinking about what that meant. And so it almost felt to me as if that wasn't really a crazy or unusual thing to her. She was just like observing it, kind of breaking it down into its component parts, trying to understand it, coming up with a discovery, and then trying it out for herself. Maybe almost like she was a scientist or something, right? It's testing a hypothesis. So again, you answer this a bit with the grit, but I mean, how is she really compartmentalizing this? Is she using some version of the scientific method? And how does that curiosity and disassociative abilities play out in the rest of the book?
I like that you compare her to a scientist, because it reminds me of another scene earlier in her life where she she kills a strange bug and mm-hmm. decides to taste it. And so she does have this visceral curiosity about the world. I think the decision to become a prostitute comes in part from the need to find a way to survive, and finding that other methods had not worked, being afraid to ask for help, and also being a teenager, having visceral reactions. It's not super unusual for someone to start that young when you're running away. So it's a little bit of all of those things.
I mean, do you feel like that was a major turning point for her? Or do you really feel like in the prostitution thing was just kind of another part of the story, just another thing that happened along the way and wasn't really a major deal for her?
No, I mean, it's definitely a major deal. Leads eventually to a larger act of violence that then pushes her away from that life. But, you know, it's also related to, I would say, the metamorphosis in the book. You know, she undergoes a physical metamorphosis that relates to that unresolved trauma, right? But it's all, you know, it's all connected through the body, if that makes any sense.
It does to me, but for those of you listening, you'll have to read the book. Because there is an amazing physical metamorphosis that that does take place. So once Pluta and Isabel arrive in New York, and, you know, especially once Isabel starts taking these regular summer trips to Rome on her own, it seemed to me as if Isabel was trying to kind of forget her former life. You know, in Argentina, she lost her husband. In Brazil, she had kind of a complete nervous breakdown, just couldn't really deal with the world, was inside. So I think it's interesting to look at coping strategies here. So I wanted to see if you could talk a bit about Isabel's coping strategies, because she's dealing with, you know, her husband's disappearance and then later in the book, Pluto's disappearance, and maybe compare Isabel's coping strategies to Pluto's and note any sort of like similarities or differences between the two.
Yeah, and I think you mentioned this earlier, that Isabel is also running away. I mean, initially the move to Brazil, of course, is for safety reasons. They feel their lives are in danger. But the decision to go to Rome is more, I guess, in a way, selfish, that she's trying to get away from her pain, going to some foreign place. But of course, she can't quite get away from it because she's still checking the news, and despite her desire to try to not, you know, like, there, part of her is in denial, of course, and so I mean, like her daughter, she's running away, but she is not attempting to confront that loss in the kind of more abstract way that Pluto is trying to confront it.
And how do you think those coping strategies succeed or not? I mean, do you have a sense that one is better than the other, either for the characters or just in general?
I mean, I think generally avoidance and denial are not good, but I think, and then, you know, what happened, you know, Pluta's running away is ultimately what forces Isabel to come back and pay attention. So this idea that you can't get away from it entirely. You need to eventually confront what it is that you're coping with. I mean, I don't know if one process is better than the other, except that some people need to avoid first and then confront.
Yeah,
I suppose, you know, in real life, and some people just want to confront it right away.
Do you have a preferred method?
It probably depends on the situation, but I'm usually short on the avoiding and want to just confront.
Just deal with it. Yeah. That seems like a good choice. I agree. So, yeah, it's an interesting point about Isabel in that she is forced to confront the issue once she learns about Pluta's disappearance, and she comes back and tries to take care of it. And, you know, there's a very emotional scene once the two of them are reunited. But to me, it's almost like it's never really, I don't know if resolved is the right word. That relationship is never really healed, or if it is, it's healed to the same broken place it was in before. It's kind of my sense. You know, but by the end of the book, she's almost totally mute with Isabel. And she instead, when she does speak with a family member, it's with Lola, who's her aunt and took care of her in Brazil while Isabel was going through her nervous breakdown. It just feels like Isabel still doesn't really know how to deal with Pluta. And maybe never did, but especially now that she's sort of the sole caregiver. I guess, what is Lola doing? We haven't talked much about Lola, but what is Lola doing that allows her to build any kind of a relationship with Pluta while Isabel is just kind of unable to make anything work, it seems?
So Lolo is Isabel's much older sister who lives in Brazil and kind of, estranged from the family. But when they run away to Brazil, she had invited them to come and, you know, encourage them to come quickly because she was worried about them. So she is, a more sensitive character than Isabel is. She sees when they arrive that Pluta needs some kind of more present adult figure. And then she continues that relationship, unbeknownst really to Isabel, while Pluta's in boarding school. They exchange some letters. She's a source of support. Even if she also has trouble communicating, she has her own way of communicating that resonates with Pluta more. She's interested in language as a way of trying to she has this vast collection of dictionaries, and she's interested in trying to understand the world through language. Whereas Pluta, in some ways she's kind of an inarticulate, she has trouble articulating her feelings. And so I think together it's a helpful kind of mother figure to have in Lolo. But then in terms of the uneasy relationship at the end, it is a changed relationship. I wouldn't say it's, 180 degrees. There's an image that Pluta has of them as they're reuniting. She kind of imagines them as two crabs, touching claws. And so like not in a necessarily in a fighting sense, but in this sort of hard-shelled but delicate dance, right? That they're kind of moving together sideways, but they will move in their way. Yeah,
that's an interesting point. Especially what you were saying about Pluta and needing help and support, because one of the other things I did want to ask is that, we see Pluta on her own for a bit, and she does go through a lot, and a lot of people are bad to her. But she also seems to be pretty good at projecting maturity, in that, like you said, she has that grit where she kind of pulls herself together in multiple instances. She deals with some crazy situations. She gets people to give her alcohol or cigarettes or, help her get a tattoo or get food. She's really able to convince people that, being 14 and a girl and on your own in Brooklyn in 1980 is something that she can manage. And yeah. I'm curious to know how you think she's able to do that. Or is she, what's her secret? Is she faking it till she makes it? Has she thought this through? And, because it's interesting to me when the pendulum swings and she does have problems again, to think about how good she is from time to time.
Yeah, I mean, I would say she hasn't thought it through. But I think part of that maturity comes from having been at a boarding school, being around older girls, not having parental authorities nearby. That's part of it. But being a teenager, you're impulsive. That getting into that car with Bobby initially, that's an impulse. And it becomes a series of impulses. But she also reflects on, yeah, the theater of being an adult, that like, oh, we can pretend we're adults and then we're adults.
Yeah. And there's so much adult content, and she definitely pretends well. So we have a mutual friend, and the mutual friend suggested that I ask you this particular question, which was, where did the title of the book come from?
Yeah, Daughters of the Air. Daughters of the Air was the original title of Hans Christian Andersen's The Little Mermaid. And The Little Mermaid is a motif in the book, comes up a couple of times. Mermaids come up. And the Daughters of the Air, actually, they come in at the end of Andersen's Little Mermaid, just as she's about to dissipate into sea foam. They come down from the air and they prevent that from happening. They bring her up into the air and save her.
That's really interesting. I didn't know that. I'm glad I asked.
Yeah. I don't think you need to know the reference to enjoy the book, but it does add, yeah, it does add a little something, I
It's
think.
good. No, it's a little Easter egg for the literary nerds. All right, so we've covered a lot. Is there anything else that we haven't talked about that you hoped people will get from the book? Any other lessons or ideas or takeaways?
I mean, I think with any work of fiction, I hope asks the reader to ask themselves, if I were this person in this situation, what would I do? How would I feel? How would I act? What would I do? And so thinking about being in a fraught political moment, how would I behave? What would I need to do to stay safe or to prevent things from getting worse. So, yeah, I mean, I was really thinking about, again, how do those periods in history recur? And just thinking about using the novel as like a tool for active memory, right? That paying attention to our surroundings and being aware of maybe what isn't immediately visible, but can be felt in the atmosphere.
I think that's great and very powerful advice, especially in today's climate. So, definitely something to keep in mind. What's coming up for you? What's next? So you've did all this work for years, and you've got this amazing book coming out, and I know you're so excited, and as you should be, because I think everyone should read this book. Have you thought about what you're up to next, or are you going to be kind of riding the publicity wave for the next little bit here for this book?
I'm gonna have to do both. I mean, I'm on a 10th draft of my second novel,
Okay.
and so I am eager to spend more time with it. I think it's gonna share the publicity train. But the second novel is about a diorama artist who works as a paralegal during the economic crisis of 2008. And set against the backdrop of the Bernie Madoff scandal. So it's sort of seeing that crisis through an artist's eyes.
That's a really interesting idea. Well, I look forward to reading it. All right, well, let's wrap it all up. I'd like to have a quick thunder round, get to know you questions, and then we'll call it a day. Sound good?
Sounds
All
good.
right. First question, what is your favorite food and or drink?
At the moment, I'll have to say takoyaki, which is like a deep fried octopus dumpling.
I've never heard of it, but it sounds intriguing.
Oh, Yeah, it's like potato and an octopus, and then it's deep fried. It's just a very interesting, and then it comes with like a little barbecue sauce and bonito
Huh.
flakes.
And do you make this, or where are you going out and getting
Oh
this?
no, I wouldn't know how to make it. No, you can get it at any a lot of Japanese
Yeah.
restaurants. Yeah.
Okay. Where's your favorite place you've ever been?
Related to takoyaki, I would love to go back to Tokyo. I think it's an amazing, I love big cities, and that one is sort of just, yeah,
The
it's
biggest,
wonderful.
yeah. Yeah,
It's
yeah. I
the
love big cities too. Whenever I travel, I really enjoy seeing how large groups of people organize themselves. It's very interesting. But I haven't been to Tokyo, so I definitely need to go. If you could, so the last question, big one. If you could wave a magic wand and change any one thing, what would it be and why?
Probably right now, reversing climate change and the damages. I just recently saw that horrible picture of a starving polar bear on a ice floe, and just things seem to be getting worse faster. So it seems like if I could do that right now, that would be super.
Okay, I agree. That would be super. Good use of your magic wand. All right, well, I think we can wrap it up there. So I just wanted to say a big, big thank you to Anka Salaji for joining us. Her book is Daughters of the Air. I'm holding it in my hands and I'm doing so because it's amazing. Everyone should go out and read it. It's available Amazon, I'm sure Barnes and Noble, anywhere else you can buy fine books.
Owls.
Anka, thanks again for joining. It was a great time.
Thank you so much, John.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Read, Learn, Live. If you liked it, tell a friend and subscribe on iTunes and Google Play. If you hated it, tell a friend and subscribe on iTunes and Google Play. And so it goes.